So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of the Media Twits is brought to you by Social Flow, which scores your content and optimizes publishing on Twitter and Facebook. Learn more at socialflow.com. And this week we have a special South by Southwest edition of the Media Twits. Joining me as co-host is Rachel Sklar, who is in Austin, Texas. She's a writer and social entrepreneur based in New York, is the co-founder of Change the Ratio, which seeks to increase visibility and opportunity for women in tech and new media. She was founding editor at Huffington Post and Mediaite. Thanks for coming on.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So what's the vibe down there? I'm obviously missing out here in San Francisco. Someone's got to make sure that nobody gets robbed here during the conference. But what's it like down there? I've heard that it's just, you know, mobbed, there were lines for everything. It's just horrendous. It's horrible. It's terrible. It's over. It's ruined. What's your take? I mean, it sounds like it's fun still.
Wow. Who are the negative Nellies you're hanging out with? It was very packed. There were tons of lines. It was mobbed. I'm speaking in the past tense because South by Southwest Interactive is over, but I remain here for music and the tail end of film. There's no question it's a very different vibe. So yes, it was very, very busy, and there was a lot going on. So I would say that the overall vibe of South by Southwest Interactive this year was exhausted / ADD / seeking just like quiet, off the grid, small things after, you know, just the overload of the huge crushes of people. That was my experience. Even the Driscoll Hotel Bar, which I love, which is super fun always and mainstay of anybody who goes to South By, was more crowded and overwhelming than I had seen it. So there's definitely the high volume was definitely sort of a factor. I think a lot of the people who had been here at South By for, you know, the old times, back before, you know, all these new people discovered it, might have their own sort of perspective on what it was like versus what it's like now. But the flip side of that is this is a reflection of the industry. It is accessible to so many more people now, and so many more people are literally making it go. It's not just the pioneers who were here a few years ago. It's being pioneered in new ways by these new actors who are coming down and want to participate in it.
No question. So, I mean, I can understand that. It's like, you know, like everything else in the world that starts out small and intimate and everyone knows each other and then gets bigger and bigger and more mainstream and, you know, more sponsors, more this, more everything. You know, there's always that people who say, oh, it's been ruined now and it's just not as good. But, you know, you can always find your own group of people, or you can always kind of, there's always some serendipity in places like that where you're just running into people or hearing a new band or finding out about a new startup or checking out a new app. There's always something that just kind of pops up. And I think that part of it probably isn't gone yet.
Not at all. I mean, if you're coming down here and complaining that you didn't find value in it, if after spending, you know, 3-4 days here in Austin with all the stuff going on, then you really only got yourself to blame. One or two sort of annoying experiences of being on the list and then having to wait in line and like that stuff happens, fine, and that's annoying. But this town has been the site of a convergence of interactive film, music, money, and players from all levels. And if you can't sort of make something happen here, then you probably shouldn't have come, because that's the point of it.
Yeah. Well, let's bring on our kind of roundtable of guests and talk about more about the show. Some of the topics we'll touch on. One is kind of the controversy around homeless hotspots. Having homeless people actually act as hotspots where you donate money in order to get Wi-Fi connection from homeless people, kind of a publicity stunt by BBH Labs that either backfired
or
disgusting or was brilliant, depending on your viewpoint, or both.
If you think it was brilliant, then I also think you're disgusting. There you go. Taking a stand.
That's important. And then also the rumor that CNN might be buying Mashable. Felix Salmon broke that story over the weekend, and it didn't happen yet. Could it still happen? We'll find out. And then also we'll talk about diversity at South by Southwest. Erin Carmon had wrote a piece about that and how it might be improving, maybe not. It's a little awkward. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. And then the big thing, one of the big things was ambient apps, these apps that kind of know who's around you and where they are. And I mean, is this the next big step in stalking, or is it a brilliant technology that we'll all love in a few years? Amanda Hirsch is editor at PBS Media Shift's Collaboration Central. She's a writer, online consultant, and performer who lives in Brooklyn. She's former editorial director at PBS.org and blogs at AmandaHirsch.com. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Felix Salmon is the finance blogger at Reuters. He's written for Portfolio and Euromoney and received the 2010 Excellence in Statistical Reporting Award. Welcome to the show.
That's a statistical outlier, that is. I wouldn't pay any attention to
Of course.
it.
Laura June is features editor at The Verge, technology-focused news publication. Before joining The Verge, she was special content editor and Gadget. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
And Irene Camon is the staff writer at Salon.com, where she focuses on politics and culture. She's also a monthly columnist at Tablet and regularly contributes to magazines and television. In 2011, she was named one of Forbes 30 Under 30 in media. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, Mark.
So you all have spent some time in Austin. I know Rachel's still down there. I guess we'll start with Irene. You had written something about the diversity down at South by Southwest, and how, you know, we've got more women, more people of color kind of doing keynotes and doing panels than ever before, but it's still kind of an awkward transition. I mean, where is it? What was your experience there?
Well, the first thing is that I think it's very important to realize that why do we even want to talk about diversity at South by Southwest? And part of it is because as these kinds of events go, it's a very open one and it's a very inclusive one in the sense that almost anybody can apply to present. And then there's a democratic voting process, which is done in conjunction with some selection by the organizers. But a lot of what's great about it is that it brings together people in technology, media, culture, music to a lesser extent. And so there is an opportunity to have people learn from each other about what's going to be hot in the future. And the more inclusive and more reflective that is about the actual future, I think the better for everybody. So one of the things that I found is that they really were trying this year, but they can't make people show up to panels. So the big question for me is, this is great. There are so many amazing people from different industries, different backgrounds, men and women representing here. Now, how do we make it so that they're not sort of this marginal thing where only people just like them show up?
What was your experience, Amanda? I mean, you've been there before, right?
Yeah, this was my sixth time at South by Southwest, and it definitely is still an uphill battle, I would say. On one level, it just makes the event a little duller than it needs to be. When you go to session after session and it's a bunch of white males, even if you don't come in with diversity as the subject in the front of your mind, after a while it just starts to get dull. I find this in other contexts of my life as well. I'm an improviser. A lot of people in the improv community are white males, and it just gets boring going to show after show. So I do think we've made progress. I think there's definitely more progress to be made. And I completely agree that if the sessions with the most diverse panels were the most highly attended, most buzzed about, that would make a huge difference. So yeah, sure, some of the onus is on the conference organizers, but some of it is just on the attendees themselves and where they choose to go and which sessions they choose to talk about.
I totally agree. If I could only just add, I think that it was
I would just qualify what I said before and say that on the other hand, some of the keynotes, which are the most significant events that happen, they did a really good job of making sure that there were significant voices that were also really diverse. And I know that Baratunde Thurston, for example, he's just wrote a book called How to Be Black. I think his keynote was extremely well attended. So that was a great thing, the great coming together of everybody's different interests. And he's hilarious.
Yes, I agree. I was actually really bummed I couldn't get into that session, but I heard wonderful things about it. I mean, it seems like unanimously people loved it, and, you know, I think that's great. The lines were definitely a big bummer at South by Southwest this year.
Rachel, and you put together like a female kind of comedian lineup, and you've been doing that now. I mean, do you see things changing in the times you've been there?
I definitely do see things changing. I think, you know, what I found last year at South by Southwest was that after going through the panel picker process, where they make a point of the vowel system and having diversity, and making sure that if the onus was on the conference attendees to make sure that their panels, you know, feature a multitude of types of people, the official lineup for a lot of this stuff is lagged a little bit behind. And so last year, I was doing a panel on women and comedy and sort of like assessing the roadblocks to women as they pursue careers in comedy that men don't have, which was featured by South by Southwest in their magazine and sort of was one of the first panels that was chosen. And it seemed like a priority for South by Southwest until the actual comedy lineup was announced, and it was 30 dudes and one woman. And so I started this show last year to change the ratio, literally change the ratio of female comedians performing at South by Southwest. And so we had about 10 people last year, and I decided to do it again this year because the lineup, while better, it's seven women performing, it was still out of an enlarged comedy lineup of more than 60 performers. So I still didn't love that ratio, so I doubled it. And I brought 10 women here, and we had a great show. And, you know, and I called it, this was a comedy show, because that's what it was. It was a comedy show. It wasn't a lady comedy show. It was just a comedy show featuring ladies. And if anybody has a problem with that, then they can go and call these all-male lineups, this is a dude comedy show.
Good. Well, I'm glad. I mean, you are changing the ratio. I mean, it's obviously an uphill battle. I mean, we all know, we've all been to technology conferences and media conferences in general that are just filled with, you know, they're male dominated, they're white dominated. And yeah, I agree with Amanda. It gets boring after a while. It just gets that kind of homogenous thing. And it's about kind of opening up things up to more voices.
I think, Mark, this is Amanda. I think voices is a huge word here in terms of diversity, because, you know, I was at so many sessions where they made jokes about quote unquote South by Southwest bingo, like, oh, someone just said gamify, you know, someone just said rock star. And, you know, there's a real particular part of the population that speaks that way. I don't use those words. And so if more people like me were on panels, not just women, but it's a cultural thing too. It's like, which sectors of the tech and media community are you putting on stage?
I mean, I think it also plays into the kinds of things that people make, right? Most people who come to South by Southwest are engaged either in media production or they're inventing things, they're having startups. When you think about, this is when everyone comes together in real life, how are they informing, what information are they getting about what the audience is? How engaged are they in what the larger community is?
Let's turn to the news that you had before, kind of at the beginning of the conference, which was that CNN was in talks to buy Mashable for possibly $200 million. That seems pretty rich for a site that was started by a teenager, when he was 19 years old, Pete Cashmore. Felix, what's the latest on that?
Cashmore has come out and said that CNN is not buying Mashable this week, so that's the latest. One of the interesting things about Mashable is that it's actually pretty closely held. I've seen numbers anywhere from 3.6 million to 20 million uniques, and the range of estimates for its revenues are about as wide as that as well. So it's really very hard to gauge what a reasonable valuation for it is, given that we just have no idea how much traffic it's getting, what its revenues are, or even for that matter, who most of its non-cashmore shareholders are. So there's a huge amount of opacity here, and my guess is that if and when this deal happens, and I still very much expect that it will, it'll be an undisclosed sum, and people will still keep on chasing after it, even after the acquisition. And there'll be an earn-out and stuff like that. So I don't expect that it'll all be nailed down and certain at any point in the future.
What do you guys think about Mashable? I mean, it seems like a kind of site that's a bit of a phenomenon.
It's the CNN of the tech media space, really. I mean, they are a kind of natural. It's kind of bland, kind of middle of the road. It's very sort of consumer focused. I don't think people in the tech industry really read it so much. It's more for the CNN.
I think people say that they don't read it, Felix, but people definitely notice. What happens on Mashable, and people clamor to get their things written up in Mashable.
Oh, they definitely there because it has this enormous audience and it really drives traffic.
Right.
Who are all these 20 million people?
I think they're global, they're young, they're tech savvy consumers. I just don't think they're in the industry so much. And I think CNN and Mashable have had a long relationship. CNN has been sort of syndicating Mashable's content for a long time now, and probably just got sick of writing lots of checks to a company which it didn't own, and felt that it didn't want to run the risk of losing that deal, given that it's probably incapable of creating that kind of content on its own. And on top of that, of course, probably reckons quite rightly that they will be able to get higher CPMs, higher ad rates, once they branded it with CNN, then it can get on its own.
It's interesting to watch this because pretty much everyone is trying to get in on the technology space at this point. It's everyone's scaling up. They're either building their own or they're trying to buy one. I don't think that CNN could build what Mashable has, which is extremely, it's mainstream, but it's also fairly competent at what it does. I mean, I think he's right in a certain extent that they don't have the personalities. They have Pete, who doesn't really write that much for Mashable anymore. But they don't have huge personalities or big names, or they don't really do high profile scoops or anything. But they are, they have a huge amount of content and a huge audience. And I think it's not surprising to me at all that CNN would want this.
I think that you're right. I think that the pairing made perfect sense. Mashable is like the opposite of TechCrunch. TechCrunch had its upheaval last year, and the future of the TechCrunch brand is really in question because all of these personalities were so emphasized and huge that their specific take became one of the major calling cards of TechCrunch. And that's not the case at Mashable. Mashable has created an ongoing, nicely humming machine that the draw is Mashable first and the writer second.
Let's turn to the homeless hotspots that were at South by Southwest, which seemed to really rub a lot of people the wrong way, including Rachel.
Disgusting.
We'll stick to her disgusting label. The deal is that BBH Labs did this stunt where basically they had homeless people walk around with a t-shirt saying, "I am a 4G hotspot. If you donate, you picking them out to donate, you'll be able to get internet access through me as a human, what they call a homeless hotspot." And that, of course, brought a lot of attention, most of it negative. And there have been some people who've also kind of defended the idea and saying, look, they're actually getting people to interact with homeless people they would normally ignore. And, this is bringing some money. It's not clear how much money, but it's bringing some money to homeless people. And it's better than just doing nothing for them. Now, Laura, you wrote about it, and you said it was the best, worst, smartest, dumbest part of South by Southwest. What's your feeling now? Do you still feel like it's kind of has this mixed feeling? Do you still have a mixed feeling about it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the gut reaction is the same reaction that pretty much everyone had, which is, well, this is a horrible idea thought up by a marketing firm with whatever their motives are. Their stated motive was to raise awareness for the homeless. Of course, there are a million better ways to do such a thing. Marketing in general tends to, I believe, I'm not a marketing person, but I think that controversy or getting people talking about stuff is the secondary motive. And with this, I think it definitely brought a range of reactions. I think once you move past the gut reaction and you stop and think about it for a minute, I started to see that, you know, it's extremely complicated, and I don't have a yes, this is great, or no, it's terrible answer. But I do think that there are some cases to be made for it sort of serving its purpose. I think if you say, well, this objectifies people or it dehumanizes them, I think what you're doing, whether you think about it or not, is you're sort of denying – the homeless as a group have very weak ties to one another. They only have one thing in common, and beyond that, they're a huge, diverse group of people. And I think to sort of lump them as one thing and say this objectifies them almost denies the individual people who participated in the program with the support of the local shelter in Austin, which is called Front Steps. I think it denies an agency to people that's not necessarily accurate. So I think on the face of it, it's extremely problematic. I think that the way that they executed it was not ideal, but I don't think that it's necessarily a horrible thing. And I think also getting any attention for something like homelessness, which is tends to be a local issue, at an event like South by Southwest is extremely hard.
But I just want to get to the core of what BBH did. And what BBH did was not try to help homeless people in Austin.
They're not interested. It's a stunt.
They targeted a stunt, and they did nothing to help these people beyond the very, very short-term use of them. And they put a price on them at $20 a day, okay? That is, say it with me now, disgusting. If they had seen it as a possibility to do a social good, and BBH is recognized, is going to create this program, train people, staff it up with homeless people who will then get marketable services and be in our pipeline. And we're proud to look at this community that people ignore and find the value and humanity in them and give them opportunities. I would have been like, that's awesome. That's innovative. That's amazing. That's a terrific use of resources and a wonderful, marketing gimmick and social enterprise. But instead, they took Katrina evacuees and bought them for $20 a day. And because these people don't make very much money, they're thrilled to make $20 a day. But just because you can get someone for that price doesn't mean you should when you're PBH at South by Southwest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think that, but I think, it's true that there's a lot more they could have done, that it's, it would have been good to create something sustainable and not just a temporary one-day thing where they made a little bit of money and then, okay, see you, that's it.
Right,
But it is something. It's still something. I mean, it's like, okay, if you said, if they had not done it, then people would not have had anything. I mean, and so it's something. And some of the interactions, I know Read Write Web had a story where they talked to one of the hotspot people, one of the homeless people, and
right.
He seemed to really like it, and he enjoyed meeting people and so on and so forth and made some connections. So you never know what they got out of it.
There were a couple of people who spoke with them. I know that BuzzFeed had an interview with one of them as well. And I think we're talking about a couple of separate issues. I mean, to say that a marketing company, which is, doing a stunt for 4 days at South by Southwest Interactive, is interested in the long-term well-being or of the homeless population in Austin is, you know, that's obviously not true. But they definitely brought, because they partnered with this shelter, they did bring some awareness to the fact that the problem exists and to the fact that Austin has a homeless shelter. And, you know, I think, I mean, maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I would like to think that that would be a positive thing for the shelter in Austin. Otherwise, I can't see why they would have done it.
As someone who wasn't there, and, you know, obviously I'm going by a lot of the coverage and things I see.
Sure.
There was this thing about ambient apps and Highlight and a few other ones that people kept talking about as, like, the biggest deal there, that everyone, you know, was using these apps where basically if you're using it, you know everyone around you that's using it and where they are. Is that something that also was just kind of one of these things that, that journalists kind of bought into and wrote about, but no one really was using, or was it actually something that people were talking about?
My experience, I don't use Highlight, but all of the other people that I was, because I don't want people to know where I am all the time, but all of the other people that I was with, they were all men, and they were all using it, and everyone that I know in media was using that app and talking about it. So I think it's a small population, but it is the population that is really visible and that writes about technology. And that's sort of what creates, definitely down there, everyone I met and ran into, for the most part, male, were using it. You know, I have like a really sort of disdainful attitude toward apps that just broadcast information like without me doing anything. But I think that you'll see that app spread. I think that something like that is it's very much the direction that things like Facebook are moving into. I don't think it's going to spread to, you know, the mass population. I think you could see it very slowly gain popularity the way that something like Twitter did.
I think I saw actually more of Sonar, like in terms of on
yes.
Twitter. I didn't download Highlight. I heard right at the beginning of South by people were complaining about how much power it used, how much battery it drained.
It kills your battery.
Whatever. Yeah.
Because
so
it
I
runs.
Actually think, like, I didn't, nobody said to me, I found you on Highlight. A lot of people found me on Sonar. So I think I agree that like everybody's talking about Highlight, and that was sort of one of the stories. But I do think that it was adopted by the people who talk about each other, and that's the megaphone.
Right. Yep.
So what's the attraction of that? Just the is it about finding people around you at an event or something? I mean, is this something that people just use in their regular everyday life?
I mean, that's really the question with something like this. At South by Southwest, where everyone either knows each other or is aware of each other already, and you're there specifically either to work or to meet other people like-minded, it makes a certain type of sense because you can go, oh, there's this person from CNN that I've, you know, talked to on the internet, and they're in the same place as me. So to a certain extent, it makes sense in that context. I think in life, it's a bit weird because it will it will like sort of tell you that people like that you're friends with on Facebook, but their friends are also like around in your surrounding area. So I mean, presumably it's to sort of meet people based on friends you have in common and also interests that you have in common. And, you know, I think that for a lot of people that's, you know, really interesting, especially if you live in a big city, which is primarily, I think, where a lot of these are used and useful.
Yeah, I will say, just to add a little diversity to the conversation, that I did not hear about Highlight
right.
until you sent me that link, Mark. So, or Sonar.
Right, and Sonar's been around a bit longer, which is why I think more people use it.
Yeah, so, you know, it could just be that I'm out of the loop. definite possibility. Also, though, I think the people I was hanging out with, and even I myself, yes, I'm connected to the media world, but not with, I was not there hunting for the scoop or trying to quickly determine what are the main headlines from this year's festival. And I think it's the people who are there with that agenda that, you know, are trying to, you know, quickly kind of figure, oh, well, these are the top stories of the festival this year. That was not at all on my mind. I was just experiencing the festival.
I guess it's just that there's always, you know, everyone wants to sum up like what was the thing, and I mean because
yeah.
2007 was Twitter and 2009 yep. was Foursquare, and it's just like, you know, what is it going to be? What's the big breakthrough? And, you know, everyone always has that question of, like, what was it all about?
Yep.
And
right.
We all want that soundbite. We all want that simple, like, CNN headline.
Yep.
You know, oh, and I think it's not just the sort of tech media. I think it's also, you know, investors and developers. They're all – everyone's looking around because it has a pretty good track record for launching or near launching things that are, you know, fairly – go on to fairly, you know, great heights.
Yeah. No, sure. I mean, it's funny. I don't know what it says about myself or the people that I travel with, but you know, to me, the main conversations were actually about the lines and about it makes us sound like a bunch of negative people too. But like, I mean, first of all, the fact that it rained and was cold for the first 2 days of South by Southwest, let us not overlook this was a major story because so many people go to South by Southwest for the Austin sunshine. So, I mean, that was like the dominant conversation. And then the fact that people had to wait 2 hours in line to pick up their registration badge. And then that starts to spiral into questions of like, is it all worth it? You know, what are we really getting out of this? So I completely agree that South by Southwest has earned a reputation as a place that launches, what you just said, that, you know, certainly the prevalence of Twitter a few years ago then was sort of foretold the success of Twitter and things like that. So I don't mean at all to gloss over that. But, you know, people are people too. So there's conversations about weather, lines, barbecue.
And I think in general,
I think actually
too,
the weather was a really important, like a really just an important indicia of readiness for this event.
Yeah.
You know, there were some of the things were so over the top. Massive, you know, like blocks taken over and you know, so basically like the people who were able to scramble for tents and get tents were able to save their events, and people who weren't were like rained out. Like I actually didn't go to the Foursquare Court this year, but I think that they didn't manage to get a tent. And similarly, Bing had put together a big activation on a corner and had not managed to get a tent. I was lucky. I was aligned with my friend Emily Gannett, who's co-founder of Change Ratio, who's also an event planner. She managed to get a tent. She got one from Dallas, drove it over here, and all of her events worked out great, including our Change Ratio happy hour.
Well, thanks a lot, y'all.
A little y'all in honor
y'all.
Of Austin. Very good, Mark.
Thanks for stopping by the porch.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host, Rachel Sklar, as well as our guests, Amanda Hirsch, Felix Salmon, Laura June, and Irene Carmon. And we also want to thank our sponsor, Social Flow. Learn more about Social Flow at socialflow.com. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to keep up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister sites, Idealab at pbs.org/idealab and our new site, Collaboration Central at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.